We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. We're proud to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find new conversations every Wednesday at bluegrasssituation.com, wherever you get your podcasts, or theother22hours.com. See you there.
And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It is me, Cindy House. Thanks for finding us today. We have Julian Taylor on the podcast. Before we get into that, let's talk about our mailing list. You can sign up for our once-a-month email at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. We'll just let you know who's going to be coming up on the podcast, who's been on recently, and all that. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube, but mostly Instagram for those keeping track at home. You can also become a contributing supporter to Basic Folk. We are listener supported. Make your contribution by going to basicfolk.com/donate, or you can find that link in the show notes. How's it going? It's April. Good to have you here. Let's get into Julian Taylor, interviewed by Lizzie No. One of the things that Lizzie really enjoyed about interviewing the Toronto-born singer-songwriter Julian Taylor is his relationship with the truth. He has a really peaceful attitude towards learning new information and sharing new information. For example, at the beginning and the end of the interview, there were some biographical facts about him that Lizzie had gotten wrong in research. And Julian gently and matter-of-fact fact-checked her, and they just moved on. It was such a cool example of, oh, you've got this bit wrong, and it matters that we get it right, but nothing about it is personal. In an era of misinformation and alternative facts, it feels really grounding to have an hour-long conversation with someone who really cares about getting it right, and that shows through his songs and in his storytelling. Julian experienced an eclectic musical upbringing thanks to his classical and gospel musician father, his mother's love of Motown and folk, and wide influences from pop to blues. Oral tradition in his family shaped how he tells a story, especially on his mother's side with his Mohawk grandfather, who was a pastor who told incredible stories. He also discusses being pigeonholed by race and genre. Oftentimes, people will think that he performs a certain type of music because he looks a certain way. He mentions that audiences can be shocked when he pulls out a country song while sporting hair that looks more reggae than Johnny Cash. Taylor discusses his breakthrough 2020 album, The Ridge. He talks about his writing process, often starting with the lyrics and the intent behind Anthology Volume 2, including the songs Hunger, Don't Let 'Em, Dedication, and Weighing Down, addressing mental freedom, identity politics, and self-forgiveness. We'll take a listen to a song from his latest release. This is a clip of the song Hunger, and then we'll get to our conversation with Lizzie No and Julian Taylor on Basic Folk.
It flew out of the sunrise like a shadow on the day, and it hovered in the clear sky like a bird of prey. Took the baby from the cradle, stole the blankets from the bed, and it sat down at their table, drank their water, ate their bread. Hunger, hunger, crossed the fields like rolling thunder. How much longer must we feel this hunger? It settled down among us like a guest who never leaves.
turned mothers against children, turned brothers into thieves. Hunger, hunger, we get old and you get younger. Hunger is the king we're living under.
Julian Taylor, welcome to Basic Folk. I'm Lizzie Noe, and I'm so happy to have you on the pod today. Let's dig right in. You grew up on the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory.
I did not.
You did not?
No, I did not.
Okay, so I need to confront a journalist who wrote that about you.
Really? See, I always have to protect myself in that regard. I'm not from Six Nations of the Grand River. I'm from Toronto.
Oh, tell me everything.
Family. I have roots and I have family in Ganawage, which is a Mohawk reservation in Quebec. Six Nations is in Ontario near Brantford, and Ganawage is near Montreal.
Okay, this is great to know. So tell me about growing up in Toronto and like what music was like for you growing up in your household and like in your neighborhood.
Sure. In my household, what was music like growing up? It was pretty varied. It was very eclectic. My dad is a classical pianist, also sang in a band. He had a gospel band called the Shepherd's Flock, which he started with my uncle. And they were in a band together for many years. So we grew up with a lot of music. So anything from, you know, Bach, Chopin, Rachmaninoff, to Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole, Bessie Smith.
All of it.
Stevie Wonder. Then my mom, her and her sister were go-go dancers back in the old days, and Motown was a huge thing for them. So a lot of Motown, you know, that was very prevalent. The Temptations and the Supremes. Gil Scott-Heron also came into the, like some really conscious music came into the fruition as well. And then it was pop. I was into pop because I was born in 1978, so by the time 1984 came around...
What an era for pop.
Right, it was big. So I was a big fan of Prince, Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, Billy Ocean. Who else was in that mix? I guess Born in the USA from Bruce Springsteen. Like Dancing in the Dark was pop, I guess. And then later on in life... Well, actually, like my cousins and stuff, they listened to different things too. So like they listened to more rock and roll and country. And blues and jazz. So it was a lot. We got inundated a lot. And my mom also was a big folk fan as well, like Richie Havens.
Oh, sweet.
You know, John Lucien, those kind of things were really prevalent in our house. So it was a musical home.
Yeah. And so was there ever a moment where you felt like there was a shift in consciousness where you thought, I, Julian, am an artist? Or do you feel like it was something that was just shared and like in the air?
Definitely shared it in the air. All of us are artists in my family. When it comes to like seeing my dad playing piano, listening to him, that's how I knew he was home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the first thing he would probably do, like if we were sleeping and I'd be waiting up, he'd go and play the piano, and I knew my dad was home, and that was really something else. So, like my cousins all played as well. Like my cousin Richard played trumpet, my cousin Paul played piano, and my grandfather, my dad's father, played piano and guitar. My Uncle Paul played trumpet. My Uncle Brainerd played everything. He was the conductor of the choir at church. Then on my mom's side, in Ganawage, my cousins Jean plays drums and Barry plays bass. And it's a lot.
So oh my gosh.
I never thought I was like an artist. I always thought I was just somebody who was playing along.
Well, speaking of playing along, tell us about your first band, Staggered Crossing, and the type of music that you were making and the type of musician that you were in those days.
Sure. We were a bunch of misfits, really, because we were teenagers. Mm-hmm. I started that band when I was 16 years old. And at first, it was like I wanted everybody to play rhythm and blues because that's what I had grown up with. And it just wasn't in the cards because they didn't really grow up with that.
Yeah.
It was the first time I was sort of introduced to a lot of that stuff was in, you know, high school. And I guess because we grew up in the 90s, Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and all of those bands broke out and we were inundated with that. I also really enjoyed hip hop though.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was really into Tribe Called Quest is one of my favorite groups still. Cypress Hill, Gangstar.
Are you a Living Color fan?
I'm a huge Living Color fan. I love Living Color. I love Bad Brains.
Yes, Bad Brains. Because when I was listening to the Staggered Crossing stuff, I was like, I feel like there is an overlap between rock roots and like folk roots in your lineage. That's a really interesting overlap.
100%. Yeah, 100%. My friends that I went to high school, like the rest of the guys in the group were, you know, all Caucasian guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I you know, when you grow up and you think that everybody has the same experience as you do, but it's just not true.
Yeah.
And so it became an amalgamation of a lot of different thoughts and ideas, and I was introduced to so many things that I had never really been inundated with. Like the drummer loved Pantera, and
hit
my scope. Like I was like, what is this? Helmet was another one that he introduced me to, but I was introducing them to things that they hadn't been introduced to as well, like Death, like Bad Brains, mm-hmm. like Fishbone, and even Living Color. Like mm-hmm. that was a cool band as well back in the day.
I love Living Color. Oh, I'm such a big fan.
So I picked up the electric guitar, but literally I thought I wanted to be Buddy Guy for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you and I first met, and a big part of why I wanted to have you on Basic Folk is that, was it 2022 or 2023 when we met at the Hillside Festival?
It was at Hillside, yeah. I don't know what year it was.
I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, but we were both put on a workshop together. And like, for people that go to Folk Fests, you'll know that a big part of the Folk Fest vibe is that you're not just seeing artists on the main stage. You're getting a chance to meet people in more of a one-on-one or a workshop setting. And like, I didn't know what I was getting into, but I was so taken with your presence as a storyteller and your ability to like translate your songs into super relatable stories for like a very broad audience. So I'm just curious how often you're in situations where you're teaching. And like, how did you develop your storytelling abilities, like even outside of the music side of it?
That comes down to family once again. Certainly my grandfather, my mom's dad, and that's where the Mohawk lineage comes from. He was a definite storyteller. It's just part of our tradition. It's an oral tradition. And same with on the African side, you know, mm-hmm. my grandfather was a pastor and he had an incredible ability to tell stories. I think that honing that skill was genetic, but mm-hmm. at the same time, once you've gone through a lot of things in your life and if you are trying to make sense of them, a lot of the time what you end up doing is you tell those stories to yourself a lot. They go through your head like a constant reel. And if that's happening, it can be really detrimental to your health.
Mm-hmm.
I find.
I agree.
So I had to discover a way of using that to its advantage.
Mm.
And I found that speaking to that instrument in my room or in my living room or in my bedroom, the guitar primarily. I do play piano a little bit because obviously my dad wanted me to when I was a kid. But speaking to that guitar became my best friend,
mm-hmm.
and a solace. And I was able to tell that instrument my deepest, darkest secrets,
mm-hmm.
which was really something that is quite an amazing gift to be able to have that instrument in our lives to do that with. What I found after that those stories became really relatable to other people because the more that I, the more experiences I have, the more people that I've met across the entire globe, I actually feel like I have more in common with them than I don't. Like, you and I have much more in common with each other than the average person would, mm-hmm. just because of our lineage and our heritage and our experiences through life because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that being said, everybody was a child once.
Yes. I really feel like being a touring musician is what really made my socialism real. Like, it was a theory and a set of ideas, but when you spend your time just connecting and meeting with people from all walks of life, you know, every night on mm-hmm. tour, you do realize we share so many of the same basic needs and the same basic concerns and the same desires. Like, yeah, I couldn't agree with that more.
It also comes to talking to people. When I first met you and we chatted, it was an instant connection with you. And I think that, like you said, touring and being a musician that, well, first of all, we also have this empathy that we're born with.
Yeah.
As artists. And I find that any conversation that I have, most of the time, if somebody's not, if I feel safe, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
If I feel safe, I'm able to open up to people and they're able to open up to me. So I've done my best to try to make music where I feel safe, where in turn other people will feel safe too, even if it's an uncomfortable topic.
Yes. Like the songwriting and the storytelling for you, it sounds like are a container for connection. In a world where connection, it doesn't always feel safe, especially with people that don't come from our same background, or like, it's a way of building trust.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. There are some stages where I've been on and I've actually, you know, come to tears because I've had the courage to tell the audience, thank you. I thank you for making me feel safe. It doesn't happen all the time.
It's correct.
And people who haven't had our experience, who aren't, you know, minorities, for instance, may not have. I've never had the experience of being a woman in that in regard.
Right.
I can only see it through the people that I have in my family or my daughter's eyes, and they can't always explain that to me too. But you have to have that sort of empathy and try to see other people for what they're going through too. So I think it's really highly important. I think safety is like one of the most important things that we have on earth.
Yes, it goes that deep. I feel the exact same way when I'm on stage. And even when I'm writing, like, I need to feel emotional, physical, and psychological safety to feel creative at all.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear about the process behind your 2020 really breakthrough album, The Ridge. And it seemed to like mark a transition for you sonically. To what extent were you intentionally crafting a new sound and image, a more folksy sound and image? And like, how did that record change your life?
Well, the Ridge changed my life in exponential ways because I was able to reach a worldwide audience
mm-hmm.
For the first time. I was also able to reach a Canadian audience for what I thought was the first time because I reached an international audience.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Sure. I've been making music and producing records and writing songs for close to 30 years now. And Canada has always been my home. Toronto's always been where I grew up and where I had my formative experiences. But, you know, I toured the country and it was hard. It's hard to tour this country. It's big, it's vast.
Mm-hmm.
It's also not incredibly kind sometimes. People have that misconception. A lot of the time, our Canadian artists have to go outside of Canada to get any sort of recognition because of, for whatever reason, it feels like there's, because it's so vast and because it's also quite small, maybe there's this sort of competitive mindset in people's psyche that doesn't allow them to really appreciate what they have here until it goes somewhere else and somebody else appreciates it, which is unfortunate, but it's changing. But that was the time when I first was coming up. At the same time, you know, I felt it was very difficult to be pigeonholed.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to be pigeonholed. I was, you know, also coached in a way to be a certain image so that it would maybe break the band or
yes.
help me with my career. I'm not going to go into so too much of it because there's a systemic problem with it.
Yes.
Whether it's your race or your gender, or let's go as simply as genre. I mean, for the longest time, the way that I look, people would ask me, what am I, a reggae artist or am I a hip hop artist? And I was never either. I can do both, and I enjoy both of those music genres, of course, and styles.
No, I mean, every Black artist has a version of that. I feel like because of my presentation, people are like, she's real light-skinned. R&B singer, solo R&B singer. And I'm like, no, I'm a folk band leader, actually. But yeah, that's very relatable.
They don't understand that. Yeah, they don't understand that. It's funny, when I was doing cover band stuff after Staggered Crossing split, I would do, you know, if I broke out a Bob Marley song, the people in the audience felt comfortable. Mm-hmm. They were like, well, yeah, well, I get this now.
Yes.
As soon as I would do something by, like, say, Johnny Cash or something like that, the look on people's faces or what they would say to me afterwards was so incredibly insulting, but
yes,
real at the same time. I can't really.
I still get quizzed all the time. What do you know about that type of, when I talk about country or folk, people just have such a resistance to seeing certain bodies embody certain types of storytelling practices because it doesn't match their subconscious biases about who can be what type of a storyteller.
It's bizarre.
Yeah. I think that's really helpful context for the brilliance with which you broke through a lot of that noise and have become such a formidable presence in the folk scene as a songwriter and a singer and a guitar player and all of those things. I want to make sure we dig in really deep to your new album, Anthology Volume 2. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, can you set the scene of what it looks like when you're writing songs? Like, do you have a favorite guitar that you go to? Do you have a spot in your house, a time of day, or are you just writing whenever, wherever?
I do have a favorite spot. I'm in it at the moment, one of them.
Oh, great.
I'm in my attic, which I created it's like a little den with instruments and the computer where I can, you know, record demos and things like that. And it also contains a lot of my family history.
Mm.
When my aunts and uncles and grandparents started to transcend and move on to the next realm, I was bestowed with the responsibility of holding a lot of their artifacts. So they're in this room with me. Some are in boxes and some are out for display. But there's a certain energy that each of them carry.
Don't you feel like every Black family has at least one or two historians / like anthologists?
The keepers?
Yes.
The keepers, yes. We have me and my mom. There's a few others.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we are the keepers of these things. And so I guess that's part of the story too, I suppose, is that those keepsakes keep speaking to me. So that's a really wonderful thing.
Whoa.
Also, I love writing in nature. If I have the chance, I'm not going out today. It's -15. So that's not a good temperature to write in. But if I get the chance, I'll sit on outside on my porch. I'll write and I'll sit on the deck and just write, or sit by a lake and write, and sit in a forest and write. And that's really, again, the keepers keep talking to me. And nature, and, you know, being from a Haudenosaunee background as well, nature has always spoken to me. I was always taught to listen to nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was interesting. My grandfather would always talk about the birds and their singing, and if you ever got lost in the forest, which way to go, listen to this animal, listen to this bird. And I was taught that way. I was taught that the Great Spirit was the guide and is the all-compassing thing that we are all shaped and come from. And we are, a lot of people, you know, coming from our background, it was interesting. There's a dichotomy because on one side of the family was, you know, religion. But they're all very spiritual people, which is wonderful because they're not in this, I don't know the way to explain it, because they're beautiful theologians and they're beautiful spiritual people. And then on one side, there's another group of beautiful spiritual people, but that didn't believe in the same sort of secular sort of ideas. So I was privy to both, which was such a gift to see that combo. And again, like traveling around the world, see how that is so much, there's so much in common, if you allow it to be. So that was really cool. But yeah, the writing process for me is really interesting. Like I think for The Ridge, that was one of the first times, however, though, that I started with the whole record was pretty much written lyrically before the music even came to fruition.
Mm.
And before that, you know, jamming with my rock and roll, alternative rock and roll band and things like that, ideas came from music, and then the lyrics, I would go back and work on that. But this was an interesting record, so it taught me that if I started with the lyrics, the melody and the shape of the songs would be very different. And so I continued to do that. I mean, and now it's a bit of a combination of both. Like, anything can happen. Inspiration will strike you at any time, and you got to run with it if you can.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working on a brand new record, and I'm done it. I've actually got the lyrics completed. I need three verses.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, I'm going in to record it tomorrow.
I'm so stoked that we're talking today. Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. It's going to be fun. It's my most political record, that is for sure.
Okay, we're going to want you back on the pod to talk about that for sure.
It's very exciting. I know that. I hope it doesn't get me canceled. But at the same time, I actually don't care.
Yeah. Black artists getting canceled is usually a compliment. It means you're on to something. So let's get into the anthology, volume two. Why start with hunger? Why is hunger the place of beginning for you?
Well, because of a couple reasons, and I'll tell you. Number one, because of what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, it is a direct segue into what's coming on this the next record. I felt that I had to, same with like Don't Let 'Em,
mm-hmm.
all of these things, all these ideas and these different. So it's the first, this record's different from any other record because, yes, it is a very personal record that I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to go with hunger, and I wanted to go with dedication and Don't Let 'Em, because I wanted to show where I'm headed.
Yes. Now, speaking of Don't Let 'Em, which is an amazing duet with Jim James, I think it might be my favorite on Anthology.
Thank you.
Who were some of your greatest teachers when it comes to mental freedom? Or maybe what? Like, what are some situations that have taught you about that pursuit of being mentally free that you're talking about on Don't Let 'Em?
Right. Well, definitely because I'm, you know, Gunagahaga and Haudenosaunee, that mental freedom, and, you know, because I'm Black, that's a thing that we grow up with, because there's a systematic constraint against who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And many people don't recognize it.
No. I think about the fact that in the U.S. for a long time, it was illegal to teach a Black person to read.
Right.
Like, if that doesn't say the foundation of what we were expected to do and be, you know, on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, I don't know what else does.
Yeah.
Our minds are really the battleground.
I think that that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. I think that our minds are the battleground. I think that our spirit and our bodies. So like the three things that everybody talks about all the time are the things that people need to recognize are really what we're fighting for. Of course, we're fighting for physical freedom and we're fighting for rights like we always have. But what I'm feeling and what I'm seeing in the world right now, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are, you know, confined by, you know, another structure. Social media is now mm-hmm. boxed us in again and is feeding us information. There's a line in my, what's the line in my new record? Hold on, I'll find it.
Ooh, a scoop.
Yeah, you get a scoop. Here you go. There's two songs that address it. One is called Silent War.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, the other one's called Fuck It, but whatever. The line is, fuck the one drop rule and blood quantum tricks. Stop reading into the white lies of identity politics. The system is built to conquer and divide, but it needs to harvest human suffering in order to survive.
There you have it.
That's it in a nutshell.
Yep. You mentioned the song Dedication. What is your secret to making drums and percussion feel effortless on a folk record?
Oh my God, it's the drummer.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I come up with a lot of ideas rhythmically
mm-hmm.
before we go into the studio, like, but I really count on the talent of the musicians in the room mm-hmm. to bring it to life. Like, if you listen to The Ridge, that's my cousin Gene Diabo playing drums, and it's my other cousin Barry Diabo playing the bass. They've been playing together for years and years and years, and obviously we're all family, so you have this sort of, family has an interesting sound.
Yes.
It's like a, like it's like blood relation. Like you, it's like the sound bleeds into one another, I guess is the best way to describe it. But and they're also on Beyond the Reservoir for part of that record.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dedication, it's Sean Monahan. She's a wonderful drummer from the UK that I met over there touring, and she's in my touring band there. Actually, my touring band in the UK is an all-female touring band, other than me, obviously.
I know, that's right.
Even our road manager is a wonderful female named Yvonne Bailey. So it's just me and five girls.
And I bet everything is efficient as hell.
It is, and they care so much. Sean is a drummer. She's one of the best drummers I've ever played with, but she's so serious. Like, she tapes herself every single show and like watches it, listens to it, studies it. And it's like, okay, she's like,
God bless.
Yeah. So actually, the girls are coming to Toronto. I'm bringing them here. Unfortunately, their flight has been delayed, but they're on their way. They are recording the brand new record of original material with me.
I am so excited to hear this new record.
I am too.
I want to know more about the song Weighing Down. That's been one that's on repeat for me. Who is the you in that song that you're addressing?
The you is you. It's me and it's you, yes.
Yeah.
That song, you know, it stems from my inability to accept my own faults,
mm-hmm,
and my own mistakes, and how those mistakes and those faults have affected those around me,
mm-hmm,
including myself.
Yeah.
I think that I'm one of the biggest culprits in my own personal life. I'm the one that's broken my heart the most.
Mm.
And I know that it's certainly broken other people's hearts and disappointed them and disappointed myself. And I was just feeling really, really incredibly down on myself at that point in time that song was written, that I needed some sort of escape. And I wrote it in this attic. It didn't take long.
Mm-hmm.
It was done in you know, an afternoon.
We love to see that.
Yeah, I do too. I like
when songwriting is easy. That's a good time.
It's a beautiful time. It's like it's as if some of the songs that we've worked on and written are already there.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't me that wrote it, it could have been you. It just is timing and where our emotional and spiritual antennas are.
Yes,
if they're connecting us to that spiritual universe and inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love words. It's like universe actually means one song. Uni in Latin is one and verse is song. And I like to break down words a lot too. You know, like community for me is common unity, and inspiration means to be in spirit. And if these antennas are sort of connecting to our cerebral and our hearts, it could be any. You could have written Weighing Down.
Yes.
It just so happened that it was me that day.
Do you have any tips for getting your spiritual antenna tuned to the muses, the universe, like how to get yourself into that safe, creative mindset?
Yeah. I mean, the first silence is number one. And the more time that I'm allowed to have by myself, the more time I'm allowed to be silent and tap into that, which I value very much. You know, as a father, as a musician and a traveling musician, you don't get that as often as I say I would have at a certain point in time in my life. But breathing is really, really something that's very healthy for us, you know, mind, body, and spirit. It does allow you to connect,
mm-hmm,
I find. Oddly enough, sleep deprivation does as well.
Yes. I wrote most of my album Halfsies during an insomnia spell in 2020.
Right?
Yeah. There's something about the veil being thin.
Yeah.
When you're tired.
I don't know what it is.
We hear a little bit of a nod to the great Elizabeth Cotton on 100 Proof. Can, mm-hmm, you talk about your relationship with her music, how you came across it, how she's inspired you as a player?
Absolutely. I mean, her, Bessie Smith, you know, Thorpe, who else?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even Link Wray. Like, these are like deep down, dirty players, man.
Yes.
And it's hard not to connect to them. I mean, Freight Train, when I first heard that melody, that riff, that way of playing the guitar, it's inescapable. It connects to you as if, like, again, another thing that was pulled out of the ether that was always supposed to be in existence.
Yes.
For us to hear. And I think, you know,
Cotton, Thorpe, these guitar players, and Link Wray, like I said, the mm-hmm. other is another one that's like with Rumble and things like that. These things had to exist, like always had to. When you listen to the difference between Big Mama Thornton's Hound Dog and Elvis Presley's Hound Dog, you're like, holy smokes.
Yeah. It's one, like one is in black and white and one is in Technicolor.
Oh, for me. Absolutely. One is like right in your gut.
Mm-hmm. One you can feel and one you can only hear. Apologies to Elvis, but it's just like no comparison for me. You mentioned being a parent, and like we don't have time to get into all of the ways in which I'm sure that has shaped you as an artist, but there's a couple of songs on the anthology that I feel like refers to that moment of noticing that being a parent has changed how you're thinking about things. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about Stolen Lands and I'm thinking about Wide Awake.
Those definitely, yeah.
So in particular, how does being a parent impact your view of your indigeneity, like your role as an indigenous storyteller? How do your kids relate to you in that regard?
Well, it's interesting because now we're at a different stage of life, and right now the door is always shut, and that's fine.
Yeah.
14, I get it. But growing, like, it'll come back. It always
yes.
does. I did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So being, you know, when my daughter was younger, I know that her indigeneity is so important to her. I mean, we've spent time with family out east and going to the powwows there. And my mother is a very instrumental storyteller in my daughter's life. When my grandparents passed, it was almost as if like I had to take the torch here.
Mm-hmm.
I had sort of slowly been coming back since I was a teenager, and I've never really left. I knew that, but there's a huge responsibility to keep those stories and that and those ideas and practices, as well as I think. It's an interesting thing. Like the way that we look at it is like all my relations means that we're all connected and we're all related. There's also like to walk in a good way, to be in a good way is really part of that heritage. To respect Mother Earth, to respect our elders, to respect one another. It's such a different way of looking at things. I mean, like even in like in the Gunagahaga language, there's really no word for like, or phrase for how are you. I guess you could say Skinagoa means like, you know, I wish you great peace and like, yeah, that's what you would say as a greeting. So it's a different, like, it's a different mm-hmm. way of looking at the world. And I have always looked at the world in a different way. I'm by no means an expert on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to my culture, I'm still learning. You know, I'm still learning about my indigenous culture, even though I always knew about it. Like there's like some people ask me about, when did you discover that you were indigenous? And I, when I was born,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was actually born with straight black hair. And my grandfather was like, so stoked. He's like, oh my God, you've got Indian hair. Well, we won't use that word because I guess people don't use it anymore, but.
Up to you how you want to use it, you know?
He's got native hair. I mean, mm-hmm. our family uses it all the time. Mm-hmm. We're black Indians. We don't care. It's like,
yeah.
Like I understand that in the media and in the outside world, outside of our circle, that people sometimes find that offensive, so I don't use it.
But you're allowed to have a nickname for your own family, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So that's what we are, and that's totally fine. And we love it, and we love each other, and you know, we all have our issues with each other too.
Yeah.
Like we're family. Like we don't always get along,
mm-hmm.
but there's always, you know, respect and love shown no matter what. From my perspective and what I put out into the world, that's my most important vessel. And it's my most important gift and superpower. It's like from the inside of my heart, I want to show and project love.
Now, would you describe yourself as a folk musician?
I don't know. Maybe.
What's folk music to you?
That's a tough question.
Listen, we're on the Basic Folk podcast and we're going there.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to.
In this moment, you are the expert on your concept of folk music. So there's no right or wrong answer.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that folk music is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I think that folk music is tradition. I think that folk music is a way of taking all sorts of different types of music, which is what I do. So I look at it as roots music too. I mean, nothing that I've ever done is in one lane. Everything's sort of very vast and all-encompassing, but I think that folk music represents those things. I think mm-hmm. that folk music represents an all-encompassing sort of way of being. And in that regard, I think that it includes, you know, tradition and heritage. I think it includes spirituality and emotion. I think that it includes, you know, social rights, and I believe that it has a fight in it. It's got a bit of punk to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it also is, it's about love and relationships. When I think about my own heritage, I look at folk music as all my relations too. It's a connective being.
Mm.
I mean, it's called folk.
Period. It's about the people.
It's about the people. It's a connective being. The whole genre is a connective being.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I also feel like you have unique and sharp perspectives about what folk music can and should be. Like, there's a line on Anthology about "This land is your land" isn't really it. Like, that's not exactly the model that you're thinking about for a shared experience of the land and music. So, like, how do we avoid that Woody Guthrie one size fits all model when we're trying to have a shared language around folk?
Oh, wow. Heavy question, Lizzie.
I think about these we share this journey.
It's interesting because I you know, this whole make everything great again,
yeah,
quote unquote. How do you do that when it wasn't great for everybody? So that you're approaching that sort of mentality where it's like, okay, this diaspora that some people believe that it's been amazing and this is the way that it should be, when that's challenged by another idea or way of thinking, the tendency to get your back up and is the most prevalent. Now, in folk music, I personally feel that it's learned a lot. It has a lot more openness to when it started. There was a point mm-hmm. in time where folk music did not have that. You know, we all hear the stories. I wasn't there, but we've all heard the stories about when Dylan went electric, for example. Let's use a simple example as that, where folk music had to learn to spread its wings and open its heart. It's one of the, you know, connective beings and languages that has enabled itself to do that over time. Not under great pressure and strife, but it has done that. I think that me saying that that wasn't a great thing for Woody Guthrie to say is fine.
I agree.
Some people, I've been attacked online about it, mm-hmm. and I've been like, well, you know, think about it. Really think about it.
I have great respect for his legacy and his family and everything
Absolutely.
That he did. And I think as contemporary folk artists, it's okay to hold our heroes to task and say, actually, I don't agree. And here's what I think our land is. You know, like, I think we should be updating our ideas of justice if we are to really consider ourselves folk artists.
Most of the time when people say something like that to me, I say, you know what, if Woody Guthrie was standing right here in front of me, he'd probably agree with me right now too.
And as folk artists, we're happy to have the debate. I think that's part of what makes this type of music important, because it's a place for realistic mm-hmm. and real conversation.
I love that about this type of music. And I think that more than ever, it's going to find a really beautiful space to have that connectivity in those conversations. And like I said, those conversations are really difficult to have, but art, music, that's where it starts.
Yeah, and it's worth it. Now, what do you want to be making in 10 years?
No more babies.
Great.
That's for sure.
All done.
Yeah, no more babies. No, what do I want to be making in 10 years? You know, I have this sneaking suspicion that in 10 years I'll be 58, and maybe that's when the inner blues man will come out.
Yeah, I see that. You know what my next question is? I was going to ask if you would ever perform material from the album Tech Noir or the Julian Taylor Band, like the funk roots side of it. Is that going to come back?
Oh, yeah. I did it on Saturday. It was so fun.
Oh, hell yeah. Now, what's the best part about playing in a more funk-based band?
Well, there is connectivity again, but it is within movement. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like when you have people moving with you, it's a different, like folk music is it's like a cerebral mm-hmm. being. The storytelling, the mind altering and mind, you know, changing. Well, altering is changing. That's being redundant. But mind altering sort of concepts and ideas and discussions and conversations come from folk music.
Mm-hmm.
Funk music's a totally different beast where those conversations happen within your body.
Yes.
And I dig that. Because, you know, if you get people dancing together, you've done that much work as well. You've broken down spaces.
No, I couldn't agree more. I have one last question, and then I want to do a lightning round with you if you're down.
Oh, a lightning round.
When you look back at your body of work as a songwriter, what are some of the descriptors that you would want to be remembered by?
I would want to be remembered for, you know, preaching love,
mm-hmm.
connectivity, openness, resilience, strength. I want to be known that, for an artist who was socially and consciously aware of their surroundings, who stood up for his people, you know, my people being, you know, the Gunagahaga and the Black diaspora around the world, who also was able to live in different experiences and meet different people to try to find that common ground and open up the palate to be able to have that conversation with others. Whereas, like, you know, just because you happen to be from a different walk of life, or just because you're a different race or a different gender or a different person altogether, just a different personality, doesn't mean that we can't have this conversation. And I want my work to be recognized for that. I want my work to be recognized for the safety that it provides. I think that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
The warmth and the safety that it provides as well.
That sounds like your music to me. Okay. First instinct, intuition questions.
Oh, boy.
Who's your favorite Canadian songwriter?
I'd probably have to say Neil Young right off the top of my head.
What is a must-have item in your bag when you're getting on an airplane?
My massager.
What is your must-have snack in the tour van?
Cranberries.
I love cranberries. What is your favorite Thin Lizzy song?
Oh, that's a good one. Showdown is really good.
Yes.
She Knows, Sarah.
Yes.
I love Thin Lizzy. That's another band that I'm like...
Three perfect answers. What is your favorite fruit?
My favorite fruit, blueberries.
What is your favorite color?
Red.
What is your favorite city to have a day off in on a U.S. tour?
Salida,
mm-hmm.
Colorado.
Oh, I've never been there.
It's awesome.
What should I do there when I go?
There's a lot of thrift shopping. I got this killer belt and a killer jacket there. There's a couple of cafes that you can check out. They've got live. We went to this live music bar. It was mental. So I don't know if you want to do that, but it was cool. It was fun. There was a funk band playing there. But it's sort of like a Tex-Mex town in like the desert area part of Colorado.
Yes.
It's small. It's cool. I played at the church there, and I really enjoyed that. But other than that, maybe San Diego. But mm-hmm.
Beautiful. These are good answers. Do you have any secret non-musical talents?
Do I have any secret? I can play hockey pretty good.
Oh, wow.
I'm Canadian.
Hello.
-15 degrees out. What am I going to do?
You got the skills to go with it. Okay. And finally, yeah. What is one song you wish you had written?
Oh my God. Well, even Bob Dylan wishes that he wrote Fast Car.
Period. That is such a good answer. Now, before I let you go, why did you name your album Anthology Volume 2?
Because there was an Anthology Volume 1.
Oh, is it on Spotify?
Yeah, I've got Anthology Volume 1 too. I was trying to put new songs together and put them all on the thing.
It's so great. Yeah. Okay, I didn't see Volume 1. I saw all your albums on Spotify and then Anthology Volume 2. And I was like, what's the implied Volume 1?
There is. It's not implied. Yeah, it's totally there.
It's existent. Julian, you've been such an amazing guest. Thank you so much for coming on Basic Folk.
Oh, it's so great to see you, man.
I'm just always learning from you.
Same. We got to hang more, man.
I agree.
I would love to see you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on basicfolk.com. Find us at folkalley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, or you can find us wherever you find your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. Like maybe that friend who is constantly surprising everyone around themselves by redefining themselves and shooting themselves into space, metaphorically and literally. Send it to that friend. All right. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Bye.